Welcome to Swallow the Gap, the podcast that delves into the critical world of dysphagia practice and education. I'm your host, Dr. Tim Stockdale, and I'm thrilled that you have come to join us for conversations aiming to bridge the gap in understanding, knowledge, and implementation surrounding dysphagia intervention. If you're a healthcare professional, a student, or anyone passionate about enhancing the lives of individuals with dysphagia, then you're in the right place. Swallow the Gap podcast is a production of Gap Education, and we are predicated on an unrelenting mission to improve dysphagia care and education. Nothing we say is legal advice. Nothing should be taken without scrutiny. We strive for accuracy, but we do not imply perfection. We value diversity in backgrounds and opinions. Therefore, our guests will not always reflect what we believe. In fact, we may change our minds on topics as we learn more because this is how progress is made. Through discussion, critical thinking, and open minds, we serve as catalysts for advancement in medically focused speech-language pathology. All right. Hello, everybody. Today, we have Dr. Carly Barbone at MD Anderson in Houston, Texas, and Faith Helzel Lemke at Huntsman in Salt Lake City, Utah. So I've had the pleasure of working with both these individuals a little bit in the past. So Faith actually graduated with her master's from Rocky Mountain University of Health Professions, where I taught for several years. And before that, you graduated from the University of Wisconsin, right?
And that's right.
A little bit of work as an undergrad with Dr. Shakir of the Shakir exercise.
I did, yes. I did a 2-year stint at the Medical College of Wisconsin in his lab, it was more GI focused, but yeah. Still an incredible experience getting to work with him.
Yeah, that's super cool. And so Carly, also through RMU, through the Hard to Swallow Catalyst for Change in Dysphagia Management Conference, someone else paid to have Carly shipped from Texas all the way up to Utah to present on head and neck cancer. It was a really fun year. That was, it was Alicia Bose, it was Deborah Suter, Julie Barkmeyer Kramer, and I think that was all of the adult people.
That was an awesome, yeah, it was a great conference. You did such a great job. I loved it.
It was fun. It was fun. I just like being together with people. But with the theme today, working at a cancer hospital, at an oncology hospital, there are several things that I want to get into and ask. But first, I'd just like for you to tell the audience and me a little bit about yourselves. What else would you like people to know that I didn't already mention?
So I can go first. I am a clinician. I've been a clinician since 2013, and I'm a clinician scientist. So I got my PhD at the University of Toronto with Dr. Katrina Steele, looked heavily at swallow kinematics during my PhD and mechanisms of swallow dysfunction, and then came to MD Anderson to do a postdoc, and here I am, and here I stay. But I feel like the most cool, interesting thing about me is that I'm from Canada and I milk that all day, every day. So if I say something funny, I'm from Canada. I don't know.
Dr. Maple Leaf.
Yeah.
There you go.
Yeah.
So very cool. So you have gone like kind of full swing from aspect for interpreting MBS with Katrina Steele over to digest at MD Anderson. I bet that, was that traumatic?
A little. In a good way, but like it is such a shift in thinking because I felt like, Dr. Steele is very nuanced and detailed. I feel like with swallowing and head and neck, it's a little bit more like global and big picture, And so I think that I'm a lot more flexible with my head and neck patients.
Okay.
It was an interesting switch, and now being able to go back and forth between the two is really nice, but at the beginning it was very hard to balance the two kind of schools of thought.
Now you're ambidextrous, you can do either
right.
Which
that's right.
Very cool. All right, Faith, what else do we need to know about you?
Yeah, my name is Faith. I'm a fairly new graduate working at Huntsman Cancer Institute in Salt Lake City. 90% of what I do is head and neck. So we are kind of embedded a little bit of everywhere in this hospital. We do outpatient head and neck clinic, as well as inpatient head and neck, and then also just kind of general oncology. So we have our foot into the door a little bit everywhere, which keeps things really, really interesting. Outside of work, I think the most interesting thing about me is my golden retriever, Tito. he is my pride and joy. And him and I just, you know, spend our time outside enjoying all that Utah has to offer.
There you go.
I like the name Tito.
Tito. Like Toto, but not.
Yes. Yes. Midwest people. And I feel like it, even extending into Canada, will have a little bit more appreciation for that name than here in Utah. So.
Oh yeah. No, I don't get it. I guess maybe Carly picked up on something that I didn't. Dr. Barbo. I don't know. This is, unless you tell me that you want me to call you Dr. something on here, I'm going to call you your first name.
Please call me Carly.
As pretentious as Carly is, I know you're going to correct me, right? No, I'm just kidding. Come on.
Totally. Dr. only.
You didn't even like, I don't know. No, because people now, they're going to really think you're pretentious. You didn't give anything even in your facial expression. You're like, yeah, call me doctor. Dr. Like, Maple Leaf Barbone.
Dr. Whatever. Maple Leaf Barbone.
Barbone, that's it. That's
no,
it.
Call me Carly.
So you are from Ontario, and Faith, you're from almost Ontario, aren't you?
Yes. Ish. Okay. Milwaukee, Wisconsin. It's close enough.
Yeah. I mean, yeah.
All right,
so both ready for the cold.
Oh, heck yeah. Look at that.
For those of you who can't see, just listening,
go.
There was a Green Bay Packers thing that was held up. So I'm going to tell you all how to contact Dr. Barbone, Carly, and so you can send her hate mail if you don't like the Packers. Whatever. I don't know. Hey, so.
Carly, I got your back.
Perfect. Perfect. Yeah,
you're all are a posse now.
Yeah, Packers fans stick together, Tim.
There you go. I guess so. I don't know. I don't call much pro football like you non-intellectuals or whatever. No. I'll probably cut that out. We'll see. But anyway.
I love it.
All right. So both working in an oncology hospital. Faith, you said you work with about 90% patients with head and neck cancer. Carly, would you similar? How does your demographic, or well, how does your...
So everyone's clinics are actually a little bit different because we have some like specialty type of services that, you know, we offer at Anderson. And so it's a little bit different depending, like our inpatient clinicians will do a lot of head and neck, but a lot of general oncology, breast, lung, lymphoma, different, you know, oncology areas. And then our outpatient, I'm outpatient. My clinic is interesting. I have a video stroboscopy clinic, and that can be oncology. Sometimes it's not, but most of the time it is. A lot of the times it's the lung patients or the thyroid patients that I'll see. And then I have a block of swallow studies, which is a mixed bag. And then my general clinic is a lot of oral oncology. So patients with glossectomy mainly, because that's kind of, I'm building a clinical pathway for those patients. But, you know, the majority of the outpatient is very much, you know, head and neck and general, some general oncology based. Sure. And then we have lymphedema clinic, like clinicians. We have a trismus clinic where we send patients specifically to oral oncology, where one of our clinicians works with the oral oncologist to build prosthetics and work on trismus. And we have a manual therapy, you know, a couple of manual therapists. So it's a little bit mixed, but the majority is, you know, right on D'Anderson. So majority is cancer and head and neck. So
that makes sense.
Yeah.
What do you think, like, if you were really trying to hook whoever's listening on getting into working with patients with head and neck cancer, what do you think is like the most interesting thing to you, or one of the things that just really, I don't know, it's a highlight of your career, or it just is fascinating?
you know, I'm pretty sure Faith will probably agree, but she may have a different view.
Okay.
I feel like our head and neck cancer patients are just different. They are, you know, they're just such a unique group of humans that are just wonderful. Like, I am obsessed with them. They're just, you know, it's not to like knock any other, you know, populations, but, you know, a lot of them are walking and talking and, you know, they kind of have this different outlook on life, being a cancer patient and having gone through, everything that they've gone through. And I just feel like they, for the most part, are, funny, and they don't take themselves too seriously. And, you know, some of them work really hard and others don't really care. And I love the dichotomy of, you know, every day there's just somebody who's like, my S's after my, you know, tiny glossectomy are very sloppy and I need to fix that. And then you have a guy with like a, you know, subtotal, and he's like, I can eat. I'm great. I'm good. So I love the, you know, they're a special group of patients. It's hard to put in.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. Yes, definitely. A very like mixed bag, but at the same time, they have so many of the same qualities across the board. I think going off of what Carly was saying too, is I just feel, I feel like I get to establish a really awesome relationship with these patients. And then, you know, with that, I feel like I really have something to offer them, you know, because especially, you know, at the outpatient level, when you get to these patients who need long-term therapy, you know, going through their whole survivorship process, and then you get patients like laryngectomy patients, when you're doing TEP management, you get to, again, offer these patients so much and build those relationships with them. And it's so, so fun.
That's pretty cool. I didn't, you know, when I asked that question or when I was thinking about it, I didn't even think from the perspective of most of these individuals are pretty cognitively intact. You know, a lot of them are younger. And so, you know, that part of getting, you know, the personality out is, I'm sure is there. But also even the idea of, sorry, I don't mean to turn this morbid so quickly, but the idea of like, these people have been struggling with the idea of life and death for a long time. Mm-hmm. So they're probably really coming to grips with, this is what matters. This is the type of person I want to be. And I bet you get a lot of authenticity with that. I would imagine, like, you don't have time to be fake, or you don't know if you have time to be fake.
Completely. I had a, I spend a lot of time with my patients, like getting to know them personally and figuring out what their goals are and what, you know, what they want to achieve and just with me and overall. And, you know, I had a guy the other day, he's like young in his 30s, and he was like, you know, I really appreciate the fact that you ask me personal questions. And I, you know, like, you don't think about it. I'm like, oh, what kind of music do you like? And he's like, oh, I love Dave Matthews Band. But, you know, like, I wish, you know, other people knew that about me, because it's part of my, you know, personality, because I really like music. And so I think that, you know, these patients are just really, like you said, they're genuine. Mm-hmm. And I also find that a lot of the times, the patients, some of them that I talk to, feel very judged, because they feel like, oh, people must think that like I brought this on myself. And so the counseling piece is just a really interesting part of sessions, to say, you know, like, cancer really doesn't discriminate, and you can have a, you know, 90-year-old who smoked all their lives and never had cancer, and somebody who's never, you know, touched a cigarette or a lick of alcohol. And so it's a really interesting group, and just a fascinating, I mean, some of the best people that I've, you know, ever met are some of my patients. So,
yeah, absolutely. I think too, it's just so interesting to be at the point where we're at with, like, risk factors for developing a head and neck cancer. You know, I think historically it was, you know, alcohol and tobacco use. And so a lot of patients, and we still get a lot of those patients, right? The older crew,
your TLs. Yeah,
exactly. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I know where you're going. Are you going to HPV?
Yeah, sure I am. You know, we get a lot of these like younger patients too now. I mean, I've seen more patients in like 30s and 40s range. And it's also really cool because the survivorship of these patients is a lot, you know, better outcomes for HPV mediated cancers. I think with all that said, you know, going off of the theme of developing these really awesome relationships with these patients, to those who are interested in working with this population or toying with the idea of working with this population, I think it's also worth noting that that can make parts of this job really, really difficult. Because you do get these really, really special relationships with these patients and, you know, outcomes aren't always great. And so I think, you know, you have to have a little bit of grit for, again, a little bit more of the morbid side of working with oncology and with head and neck.
Yeah.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. A lot of sense. About HPV and some of the like laryngeal cancers, I'm trying to think when I heard about that. I think it was probably way too late, like 2018, maybe 2017. Do either of you feel able to like further elucidate that, like the link between? Yeah, sorry, Carly, you're shaking on your head.
So I just want to clarify the oral, like the OPC HPV mediated, the most of those cancers are actually found at the back of the throat. So those are not laryngeal based. They're base of tongue, soft palate, and tonsil. That's like the large majority of the HPV positive.
That makes sense.
And, you know, like Faith was saying, you can get a lot of young people who come in with oropharynx cancers. Majority are, you know, young, healthy men in their 50s, 60s who are CEOs, lawyers. And, you know, like Faith said, they have very good outcomes most of the time. There are three risk groups. There's a low to intermediate risk group, kind of a middle risk group, and then a high risk group. And that has to do with smoking history and the, you know, HPV. And so, you know, a lot of these patients, like right now, our primary, you know, workhorse is radiation for these individuals. And so, you know, I'm sure you guys are, you know, same at, out in Utah, where, you know, we're seeing patients who are really young, they come in, they get radiation, and then 5, 6, 10 years down the road, they're dealing with a lot of the long-term toxicities. And so that's why, you know, we are so big on prophylactic swallowing exercise. I remember when I was doing my rotations in Michigan, and it was, you know, one of the first ladies that I had seen for a modified. And she said, you know, I just woke up today and I couldn't swallow. And I thought, what? Like, you know, that's crazy. And then when I dug into the literature, you know, that late radiation associated dysphagia is real. And so that's something that, you know, these people are really young and they're healthy for the most part, you know, and they get treated, but then they live with, you know, lower quality of life and swallowing issues, and, you know, that is progressive in terms of their dysphagia and, you know, cranial neuropathies. And so, you know, HPV is kind of like the sexy cancer in head and neck right now, just because, you know, it's a lot of young people and the cure rate is so high, but it's hard in terms of their sequelae, you know, in survivorship, because, you know, the longer you go out and mature into your survivorship, the higher, you know, you're at risk for toxicities, right? Because of how the radiation impacts the tissues. It's, you know, mucosa, muscle, cartilage, bone, nerve. And so, you know, we see now patients who are coming back with hypoglossal palsy and things like that.
Wow, that's really fascinating. Both of you have really highlighted some of the interpersonal connections that you make within this. And I like where you were going with that too, about with the prophylactic care. So when I think about prophylactic care for patients with head and neck cancer, like I'm thinking about exercises, but you brought in a really big piece of that with the counseling, like, hey, that's something unique about this population because you know in advance things that are common. It's not like you're seeing someone who's had a stroke or has been diagnosed with ALS. Well, I mean, that you would do some pre-counseling too, but still, that's a very interesting part about kind of the front loading what you're doing too.
Yeah. Faith, do you guys have a pathway for your radiation patients? I'm assuming you see them beforehand, tell them, you know, what's going to happen and give them a heads up. And yeah, I'm curious to know what you guys do.
Absolutely. And I think a lot of what we do is based off of MD Anderson's research on prophylactic eat and exercise. I think we could have a whole 2-hour discussion just on prophylactic eat and exercise. But yes, we are seeing these patients. We do what we call pre-radiation counseling. So we see them, at the time that they, get their radiation diagnosis, I guess, if you want to call it. And so the really cool thing is that, again, we already get to kind of see these patients and have this established relationship by the time they get to that point of deciding radiation, because we've seen them for preoperative counseling. We saw them inpatient post-op day one. We did their post-op MBS. We did, all these things, and then they decide to get radiation. So it's really cool to be able to kind of follow them through that whole point. Once they get to the point of radiation, again, we do a pre-radiation counseling where it's basically an hour-long spiel of here are all the side effects that can impact eating and drinking. Here's the ways to mitigate that, right? And again, with a huge highlight on continuing PO intake throughout radiation treatment. Carly, I don't know what the typical pathway for what radiation oncology by you guys is recommending. Our radiation oncologists here typically do prophylactic G-tubes. And so a lot of it is working with yes, you're going to be getting a feeding tube, but you need to, realize that that's a backup, right? Mm. The most important thing that you can do is be eating by mouth. And then as well as doing a prophylactic exercise program with oral pharyngeal exercises based on sometimes, the impairments that we're seeing on an MBS, plus, again, all the exercises that have been shown in the literature to be effective through radiation treatment. Carly, I'm interested to get your take on, I often have patients, I think a big side effect that we don't talk about enough that has an impact on eating and drinking is just fatigue, right? Radiation just takes so much out of these patients. And, I tell them you're just not going to feel like eating, and you have to think of eating as an exercise.
Yeah.
I'm curious if you had to pick, a patient eating by mouth or doing their exercise, if it came down to one or the other, what would your advice to these patients be?
That's a great question. And one that, I think we can probably talk a little bit about data. In the updated Eat and Exercise paper that I wrote last year, we had a really nice big cohort of patients with validated outcomes. And so it wasn't just diet from the chart. It was diet per PSSHN and, whether or not they really adhered to their exercises and whether or not they had a feeding tube and when it was placed. So what we found was that at 3 months, patients, had a quicker kind of return to a solid diet. They had less feeding tube duration and placement, and they had less dysphagia if they ate, and better quality of life. So their MDADI scores were higher. If we looked at exercise, better return to a solid diet, less feeding tube overall didn't really impact duration, but the one factor that stuck when we looked at them, the data or the outcomes at 2 years, were patients who exercised had a better, a wider diet range, and they had less aspiration or penetration. So a lower safety grade per digest on their modified at 2 years. And those were the only factors that were significant and they were only related to exercising. So if I were to like talk about the data, you know, I think there's a lot of factors in play that we really can't account for. And so that's why Kate Hutchison here and Rosemary Martino put in a grant to look at the dosage and whether eat or exercise or both were most beneficial. And so I'm really eager to, you know, awaiting those data, because I think that's going to be what kind of tells us, because it's a large trial, it's multi-site, different, you know, head and neck cancers, anybody with bilateral RT to the neck. So you could have an oral cavity and also an OPC. And so I think that is what's going to drive home our, you know, clinical decision making. Yeah. But I also think that, you know, I always say that, I tell people, like, this is a, you know, a decimal point in all of life's decimal points. And so what we're trying to do is get you through this successfully. And so we actually don't prophylactically peg or, you know, place feeding tubes. Usually it's kind of like a 10% loss of their weight is what will trigger feeding tube placement in these patients. You know, because I agree, it's fatigue and pain that really it's talking about, like, definitely pain management and, you know, how can we get them to eat? And Faith, are you familiar with the EAT staircase?
I'm not, no.
So, so there's a paper called EAT, E-A-T, all the way through radiation. And the staircase actually started with clinicians at Princess Margaret in Toronto, where they created a staircase that had essentially, you know, regular diet at the top. And then with each step down, it's like, you know, regular diet and then modified to, you know, softer foods that are chewable, and right, then down another level all the way to thin liquids. And so that's, we use that when we counsel patients before radiation, and we'll say, okay, so here's the staircase. And what we want you to do is think about how you can step down and make adjustments instead of fall off, right? So, you know, yeah, we're like, okay, thin liquids, that may be a 5-pound weight for your throat. But if you go all the way up to maybe chewable soft foods, that's like a 50 or 100-pound weight. And then regular foods are going to be the maximum. But it doesn't mean that you have to be there all the time. And as long as we kind of prevent that disuse atrophy and keep swallowing, even if we're doing thin liquids, or if we're doing thin and thick liquids, we're still getting some benefit out of it. I really like the staircase. Highly recommend.
Yeah, we'll definitely look into that.
That's really interesting. So it sounds like it kind of gives them the understanding of how much work they're going to be putting into something, so they can kind of be more more cognitive or cerebral about that.
Yeah. And I think it also gives them a little bit of, like, grace, so that they know that, like, okay, I don't need to be doing all of these tough foods when, you know, people say eat, they think, like, oh, like regular diet. And of course we want those heavy foods. Foods are exercise, you know, and resistance, but I think it gives them a little bit of a, you know, like a mental break to know that even if they're still doing liquids, that they're taking something by mouth.
Sure.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Very cool. That's not a question I would have asked, Faith. Thank you. So for those who are, well, actually a couple things I wanted to clarify, OPC, oropharyngeal cancer, right? Okay. You're fine. You're fine. There's going to be such a broad, a broad diversity of people listening. And so there are a couple of things, like, I didn't want to interrupt you, but like, oh yeah, OPC, oropharyngeal cancer. And, and there was one other thing earlier. Oh, I said it. I said HPV, human papilloma virus. Just if you think about those going through, you know, throw them out there. I think, you know, 90% of people will know, but just in case. But yeah, so I wanted to say, so we were originally, Carly and I were originally scheduled for Friday, or no, not Friday, was it Saturday?
Saturday. Yeah.
So you were traveling and not feeling well. And then like, I kind of got sick on Sunday. And so different things going on. But so last night, the night before I thought about rescheduling this, I was like, wait, Faith is up at Huntsman. It's like, she's up there. It would be so cool to have like a third person within this. And Carly, you're laid back. So you're like, oh, that's fine. Let's go for it. And so, yeah, I really appreciate you coming on in such a, like a moment's notice, not even because I mean, I've worked with patients in a more like a community hospital setting or a larger,
right.
a broad hospital, but not so specialized as this. And so I know a little bit. Emphasis on a little bit. I mean, so this is very helpful. I appreciate the depth of your questions, where you're going.
Absolutely. Yeah. I'm happy to be here. Always happy to nerd out with people on SLP things, especially head and neck stuff, because it is such a niche population and it's hard to come by these conversations. So very happy to be here.
So I'm sure many of these people have heard of MD Anderson's Swallow Boot Camp. Do you mind telling us a little bit more about that?
So the boot camp, the majority of the patients who we present at boot camp are those late radiation associated dysphagia, or we call them like late rad patients who come in for an MBS. They have a severe, profound dysphagia. And so what will happen is we'll kind of congregate as a team and talk about, you know, what next. And okay. So the majority of those patients have had radiation. They're, you know, years into survivorship. How many of those patients, the late rads, are you guys seeing at your hospital?
Yeah, I honestly would say that we're not seeing a huge, huge population of those. I like to think it's because treatment of head and neck cancer and multidisciplinary treatment of head and neck cancer has come such a long way in the last few years that I like to think that these patients are just having better outcomes and therefore we're not seeing them as much. But it is such an interesting discussion of, you know, these patients who are coming back 5, 10, 15 years later with this radiation induced dysphagia and are kind of like, okay, help me now, right? And so it's, I guess, what are you guys seeing as far as both evaluation and treatment outcomes in these patients with late radiation-induced dysphagia?
Yeah, I mean, it's a tough one. And I love working with these patients, but it's also it's tough. Because, you know, I think that as much as, you know, we have a lot of advancements in our organ sparing treatments and radiation and de-escalation protocols and, you know, clinical trials. I do still think that, you know, if you have like 60 grade of the bilateral neck, you know, there's a large a pretty high risk in, you know, dysphagia as you mature into your survivorship. And so, you know, a lot of the times what we'll do is put patients on maintenance swallowing exercises after their radiation, which is nice because, you know, I think I always tell my patients up front, this is something that is going to be long-term to, you know, mitigate any decline because we know the risk of progressive dysphagia, you know, in this population. And the good thing, I think, is we also have a protocol where, you know, we're looking at their swallowing objectively at baseline, but then also at 3 to 6 months and 18 to 24 months. So at that point, if there's somebody that, you know, comes back who had a great, you know, baseline normal swallow, and at 3 to 6 months, it's a little bit rocky, they may have a mild dysphagia, we'll start aggressively, trying to rehab them. So that way we can kind of get ahead of the curve. And, you know, at 18 to 24 months, if they're good, you know, we'll say, see you in 5 years. Some of the patients are then referred back to us through survivorship. So, you know, because our PAs are so awesome. And, you know, they ask about swallowing, they ask about voice, they ask about, are you coughing when you drink liquids? And so yeah. that triggers them to kind of come back to us. But I've had so many symptomatic referrals back into my MBS clinic. And, you know, the patients got a really severe, you know, dysphagia where they're chronically aspirating in trace amounts, and they've got, you know, poor base of tongue retraction and a lot of pharyngeal residue. And so, you know, those are those patients that really it's like, you know, they wake up one day and then, but it's funny because they also say, oh, I've noticed that there's been a change since my treatment. And so, you know, it's managing those guys. And then, you know, a lot of the sequela in terms of ORN, so osteoradionecrosis, we get patients who have had, you know, necrosis of the mandible who then have to have a mandibulectomy and surgery. So then it complicates everything because they've already, you know, are at risk for this severe dysphagia, and then they have a surgery. And so, you know, our now frame of mind is how do we optimize these patients before their surgery to really get their swallow at its best? So that way they don't tank after their surgery, because then they're very stiff and their tissue's fibrotic. And there's just so many things that are going on in these late rad patients.
Absolutely. What like treatment tools and modalities are you guys using in this boot camp?
In boot camp, so when we meet, we look at the pathophysiology of the swallow, and it's targeted directly towards, you know, what's going on in terms of their deficits. And so we, you know, I'm going to throw out a bunch of options that we might use, but by no means, you know, we make sure that they're really targeted to each person. So, you know, we use IOP, and I do a lot of lingual strengthening and lingual endurance, because a lot of these guys have those fasciculations on the tongue, and, you know, they have that starting of the hypoglossal neuropathy. We'll do range of motion if their tongue, you know, function is limited. And then EMST, if a patient needs it, and, you know, it makes sense in terms of their deficit, and also for velar function, because you know how a lot of those guys, they come back and their, you know, velum is kind of stiff and fibrotic. So it's kind of, we'll use, you know, EMST. We also have manual therapists who try to break up that fibrotic tissue in the neck to help with range of motion and neck extension and things like that. So, and then swallowing exercises, and they're all kind of ways to optimize current function. We also work a lot with GI, because if the patient has a suspected stricture or some type of bar, we'll try to get them into GI so that way we can do a, you know, a dilation to optimize. And then after we'll do, so after we optimize them, we'll typically do another MBS, and then and then see if the patient would be eligible for like a bolus driven therapy.
So Carly, what you're still placing a high emphasis on matching the exercise with the specific pathophysiology, it sounds
every
like.
Every time.
Absolutely. That's excellent.
Every time.
And that, what I like about that is, so you are both in very specialized types of clinics, but you know, other people who are listening, who are in training or who are in a hospital and see just a wide breadth of patients, very different types of patients, these types of recommendations would apply very well to them. You know, they, I mean, they should hopefully be matching their exercises with specific pathophysiology.
So,
don't throw that out just because, you know, one particular exercise has shown high efficacy in patients with head and neck cancer. But beyond that, so for these individuals who aren't in these specialty clinics and are getting patients with late radiation deficits, what's some advice that you would really give to them? What would you look out for?
That's a really good question. I think like the first thing is to kind of meet the patient where they're at. Because a lot of the times they're scared about getting a feeding tube and they've lost some weight if it's already gotten, you know, too far. But I think it's, you need to be realistic. right? Because I think at this point, and I don't know if you agree, Faith, but yeah. at this point, like, we've had decline. And I think, you know, it's all about kind of maybe getting a little bit better and rehabilitation, but also sustaining their current function if it's Absolutely. Working for them. And if they've managed and if they've been managing with this, you know, severe dysphagia for years.
Right. And yeah, it is such an interesting conversation. I think it really, these patients force you to have a sit down, realistic conversation and kind of face the facts, as you as a clinician cannot fix everybody. And I think that's a really hard point to get to as a clinician who went into healthcare to help people. But I mean, these are some of the hardest conversations. And I've had a couple in the last few weeks where, you know, these patients have, you know, been 15 years out and they have a severe or profound dysphagia per, you know, the digest. And we have this conversation of, okay, what is your goal here? Because based off of your structural and functional deficits, there's only so much that rehabilitation is going to do. There's only so much that swallow exercises can do. And so, you know, what are your goals? What are you looking to gain from this? And what can I offer you in, you know, conjunction with that? And sometimes it's not even like, for example, I had a patient who, you know, had such severe atrophy of his postpharyngeal wall. And he, like, you know, had such a profound dysphagia. And, you know, we sat down and had this conversation, looked over the MDS, was like, here's the structural impairments that we're not going to be able to fix. But he was also grossly aspirating and clearing absolutely none of it because his pulmonary function was not great. And so we talked about, okay, do we introduce things like EMST, actually focus more on respiratory rehabilitation to maybe become a little bit more of a functional aspirator, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. So it's really interesting in these patients. It's definitely not black or white.
No. And that's a really good point. And it's like, functionally aspirating, yeah. right? Or like, mm-hmm. how do we minimize the aspiration, even though we're not able to completely, you know, get rid of it? And so it really is about strategies too, for sure.
You seem like you're looking at it very comprehensively. Like I picked that word function out of there, and I'm thinking like you probably have to get past this idea of what's normal or what's typical. Oh. Like, you know, what is it? 0.5, 3 seconds after the bolus passes the ramus of the mandible to the hyoid birth, you know, those norms, and really focusing on function, because yes. you have a different sample size, totally different sample size of people you're working with. And I would have to say that's probably one of my favorite things about the perspective that you're looking at. It seems like you're looking at big picture outcomes. So nutrition, hydration, pulmonary health and quality of life, those in particular. Yeah. And so anchoring their swallow back to those functions. And so then, like with one of the examples that you mentioned, Faith, if somebody is aspirating, well, you're not just working on the swallow. You can work on the swallow too, and maybe decrease the amount of aspiration. That's huge. But then you can also work on pulmonary rehabilitation, because why right. do we care about if someone's aspirating a lot of liquids? Well, pulmonary issues, right? So you're taking this broader perspective of that and probably emphasizing oral hygiene and different things like that. That is so cool. That's been a huge soapbox of mine lately, is this whole idea of functional. And this really exemplifies that so well.
And I love the fact too, that even for EMST, like we have data, you know, a small cohort, but we have data that show that EMST not only helps to clear that like pulmonary toilet, and helps, you know, to increase and strengthen the cough function, but also that, you know, for a subset of these patients, it may help to, you know, achieve a better approximation of the cords, or like, you know, the laryngeal function and laryngeal closure, you know, during the swallow. And so we certainly need more data on that, but I love it because, you know, you're working on two different aspects towards a common goal. So,
that's super cool. Yeah. And to me, respiratory muscle strength training, it's one of the few things that we do that's actually predicated on principles of exercise physiology, like getting your max and then going to a certain percentage of that and doing so many repetitions.
Again, that and IOP.
Well, No. I'm sorry. Did I say? I may have minced my words, but what I meant, like, if you get your maximum expiratory pressure, if you're doing expiratory muscle strength training, and then you're shooting for between 60% and 80% of your max expiratory pressure, and training at that, typically closer to 80. I don't know. What did I say that mixed that up? Because
you said it's the only thing that we do that's based on exercise. Oh.
No. Well, it's not the only. It's one of the only.
Yeah.
Did I say that? Yeah, I'm sorry.
I'm just bugging you. I'm just grinding your gears, Tim.
That's fine. I'm gonna lay the smack down on Canada in a little bit for some of those jokes out there. I really don't want you guys to find out where I'm from, because it would probably be pretty easy for you to make some stuff and make fun of me.
I feel like I should know this.
You probably should.
I definitely did at one point.
Yeah. I hope I don't get any hate. Oh, man. Okay. I'm from West Virginia originally. And so just very different culture. And I was from Morgantown. And so that's the university town, and it's the relative melting pot of the state. Right. But yeah, I'm sure that there's some jokes you could throw out there, and probably a lot of them would really be true as it applies to me. But anyway,
I wish I knew more about West Virginia, but I can't say I do. So I can't even bug you about it.
Oh, look at that.
Look at that. So Canadian. Well,
what's that? You're too Canadian.
Yeah. So Canadian of me to not know about, U.S. states, but.
Yeah.
I'm right there with you. I know nothing. All that's playing in my head right now is John Denver's Take Me Home Country Road. So.
Okay. As long as it's not like banjo music or mandolin, which I love. I love mandolin and banjo. I don't know. I love the culture, but whenever I moved away from West Virginia, I moved to Tampa, Florida. Everyone's, you're from West Virginia? Like, there were just the different perspective, because I'm like, yeah, I'm from West Virginia. Like, I love West Virginia. I still do.
You stand for West Virginia.
People are extremely loyal, and I am. But yeah, no, people have a few West Virginia jokes, and so that's why I didn't want to give you ammunition. But yeah, I forgot you're from Canada. You don't know these things, so
no, don't know much.
Right. Well, I think, I don't know, we should probably wrap up. I've taken a lot of your time, really appreciate some tremendous insight. And I'll end with a couple of questions. One comment. There's been a really neat thread throughout this that's focused a lot on interpersonal communication and interpersonal relationships that's gone all throughout this, from the pre-counseling to getting to know the individuals who are much more cognitively intact than kind of our relative population of patients with dysphagia. And that alone has made me feel more interested in working with patients in this subset. So Faith, maybe if y'all need anyone for PRN help up there, give me a holler.
Yes. But, always could use it.
Yeah. It's not too
We're
far.
Also hiring at MD Anderson. So, if anybody wants to come on to Texas.
Not if I have to work with you. I mean,
okay. Charlie, I'll come over there. We can be the Packer fans in Texas. And then Tim, you can take my job.
There you go.
Yeah. No,
come
I'm sure
down,
that
would Faith. Come on down.
An amazing opportunity. Just on ending, I'll give you a couple of options. Would you rather, what's just some general advice that you would give to individuals who are seeing these patients in maybe more of a broader healthcare setting? Or if you really want to get into some self-deprecation, what's a mistake that you've made? And maybe by talking about it, other people won't make that mistake. I don't know.
That's a good one.
You got a good one?
I like that. I like the mistakes. I feel like we don't really talk about our mistakes enough.
I agree.
So I like that.
Yeah.
I've made quite a few. quite a few.
I feel like I could maybe answer both and one, hopefully a little bit inspirational segment.
All right, Faith, take it home.
So I think, I feel very strongly that, again, because head and neck is such a niche population, there is not enough education for, students and even other clinicians looking to work with this population. I think my biggest piece of advice for anybody that is interested is to shadow, find a mentor, find, you know, somewhere like MD Anderson or Huntsman or anywhere that's doing this kind of work, and go spend a day, spend a couple days, really get your eyes on what's going on here. Because I think the most challenging thing about this population and teaching this stuff is you just can't teach it by talking. You can't. You have to really get your eyes on these things. Like even something as simple as teaching the difference between a tracheostomy and a laryngectomy. You know, things like that are just so difficult. Or, you know, if I were to say, like, we did a post-op MVS on a flap patient, how many people are going to look at you and be like, what the heck is a flap? And so I think, again, just getting your eyes and hands dirty with this population is so important, and learning more. You know, kind of going off of that, before I was at Huntsman, I was at a smaller outpatient ENT clinic with a physician who was doing head and neck surgeries, but at a much different scale, And I was only seeing these patients like 2 weeks post-op. And then I, you know, was looking at coming up to Huntsman, and they're like, oh, do you have experience with head and neck? And I was like, oh, I sure do. You know, I have all this great experience with head and neck. Yeah. And I was like, I'm ready. I can start. And so I felt really confident in, you know, being able to come up here. And then I got up here, and again, there were so many things that I was just like, holy cow, even within that 2 week period of me like not seeing these patients, so much happens. And so again, it would have been, even just like coming up here for a day and shadowing before I started this job, would have been so eye opening to what actually goes on between those gaps. Right. And so I guess not necessarily like a failure, but kind of a learning opportunity of, you know, if you have these opportunities to be in these situations and be in these hospitals, absolutely take advantage of them.
Well, I mean, with the idea of failure, as much as I like to make fun of you both, I'm not saying, you know, don't tell me something you messed up with so I can tease you, because man, you'll find something out about me and I will not live it down. But it's reframing failure, right? It's reframing we fail, and so we can learn more. You know, it's with the cliche, like there's this commercial with Michael Jordan. He's like, I took 8 billion shots before, you know, you know, I missed 8 billion shots or something like that. And then he's like, oh, I have to fail to succeed. And you know, but it's a true message. It's cliche, but it's very true. And so even by you saying like, I didn't know what I didn't know, so absolutely, go shadow so you can know what you don't know too.
Yes.
I mean, that's part of growth. It parallels, you know, what we learn from failure. So,
well, yeah, I can't. Sorry, go ahead.
You would rather fail with or make a mistake with a mentor who's going to steer you right, so that way you learn. And I always say, like, whenever I learn something now, I'm learning for my patients, right? I'm learning to do better by them. And so, you know, failing isn't a bad thing. It's doing better the next time for somebody else when you're by yourself. So I think it is really important to shadow, especially in this population, because there is, you know, even though they're, you know, very like cognitively intact, walking and talking, you know, a lot of these patients are really sick and there are a lot of things that can go wrong. So.
And a lot of the times they can tell you,
they know
more than you can
do.
Tell them. So that's also,
for sure.
Ooh. Well, thank you all so much. This has been great. I feel like we could probably talk all day and split it into multiple episodes. 30 minutes. Boy, that's what I was shooting for first. 30-minute digestible segments. You can't get into enough depth with it. So how can, if people want to learn more about working with patients with head and neck cancer or you know, with any type of cancer, what do you have a good resource to kind of steer them to? I mean,
I would say there are like some seminal articles But I would go ahead first and look up, like, you know, the basics. How do you stage head and neck cancers? What are the, you know, main treatment regimens? Looking up, you know, eat and exercise, looking up radiation, like associated dysphagia. We wrote a paper when I was in Toronto about the not only the effects of RT, but what exactly radiation is and how it impacts tissue, right? So like all of those things, and I would say just try to educate yourself on the things that you can and look to the literature, because that's going to be your first, you know, starting point. And I'm sure there are, you know, a lot of great head and neck books out there as well. But you know, there's also some really good, so Kathy Lazarus or, Susan Langmore wrote a negative trial on, eSTIM in these, in radiation associated, you know, dysphagia patients. And so like looking and combing the literature and, so that way you come prepared to ask questions, I would say, you know, because I think that's the most important part is asking questions and, you know, reading up on it.
Yeah. And that forces self-reflection too. What do I know versus what do I don't know? And then you kind of take it.
Yeah. There's nothing more dangerous than people who have no idea, you know, who like think they know what they don't know. And so, you know.
Like me.
Well, yeah, you're dangerous, Tim. You are dangerous.
I am dangerous by my own will because I want to. So much I don't know, and so much we all.
You know, when we have a list of papers that we typically will like give our interns and things like that, is just kind of those basics. So, you know, feel free to reach out if you ever, you know, want any of those.
Okay, cool. And so, what's the best way for people to contact you? Do you want them to reach out to me and I can point them in your direction or?
Sure. Okay.
Yeah, whatever works. All right. So tim@swallowthegap.com or Instagram at swallowpatho, P-A-T-H-O. I've learned a tremendous amount and I'm going to have many more questions and going to have you back on later to answer those questions, or I'm going to be sending emails late at night bugging you about something that I don't know.
But only if you end with saying go Pat, go.
Oh, dear. I don't know. I mean, what does that even mean? I'm not that much into the NFL, but okay. Go Pack, go.
There we go.
Like Pac-Man, maybe?
Packers.
Just leave it there.
I'll leave it at that.
I also just want to like take a quick second to thank you for this initiative and for doing this, because, you know, this is a very understudied, I don't want to say underserved, but like the interest is sometimes it's there, but we don't really have a lot of, you know, focus on it. You know, and so thank you for having us on.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I appreciate your passion and your really, your focused knowledge on this has been great. All right. Lovely seeing you both.
Yeah.
And have a good rest of your week.
You as well.
Thank you so much for tuning in today. We hope this episode has been engaging and beneficial to you. If it has, please like, leave a review, share us with those in your community. We know that together we can do more than any one of us can individually to improve the level of competency with which we provide services for patients with swallowing disorders. So thank you so much for being a part of this, and we welcome engaging with you in the future and invite you to please tune in for future episodes. We have some exciting things coming up, and with your help, we truly look forward to making a difference.